Court. Would you come up and give us your testimony? We're only going to do the public hearing today.
Members of the committee, good morning. For the record, my name is Floyd Lanter. I'm the administrator for the Division of Finance and Corporate Securities, a member of the Department of Consumer and Business Services. The division has oversight responsibilities for 15 program areas, including the securities industry here in the state. I appear here today to request your support of Senate Bill 194, which provides for three technical changes with respect to Oregon securities law. First, it deletes obsolete references to registration of certain securities offerings and the licensing of certain investment advisor firms. The references at issue emanate from the enactment of the National Securities Market Improvement Act of 1996. Second, it deletes references to the securities licenses of individuals employed by mortgage brokers or mortgage bankers. Those individuals are now covered by provisions of the Oregon Mortgage Lender Law. And last, it modifies language in licensing provisions to clarify that persons acting in the broker-dealer industry and the investment advisor industry are subject to comparable treatment under law. The balance of the testimony submitted provides further detail on these technical areas. I'd be happy to provide further background on these areas or answer other questions for you. I appreciate the opportunity to appear before you this morning.
All right. Thank you very much, sir. Any questions? There are no questions. Senator Ringo?
Well, good morning. I just had a question on page 6 at the bottom, line 45. That statement says, unless the investment advisor representative is licensed under the Oregon securities law to the state investment advisor. Can you help me understand that?
Chairman, Senator Riegel, could you repeat the question, please?
I'm sorry. I'm just looking at the language that we're adding on the bottom of page 6.
Okay.
At lines 43 through 46.
Right. I don't understand the last few words of that, the very last part of that. To the state investment advisor. Can you help me track through that?
Yes. Chairman, Senator Ringo, again, this is a very technical area that emanated out of the National Securities Market Improvement Act of 1996. What that did was provide for two versions, if you will, of investment advisors. The first version of investment advisor would be for those that manage accounts in excess of $25 million or more, or provide investment advisor advice to other investment advisors. And so, because that was a federal preemption of our state statutes, what this does is allow us to regulate those investment advisors that manage accounts less than $25 million or do not provide advice to other investment advisor firms.
Okay. Makes sense. So you're acknowledging that those people that might do advising for portfolios of less than $25
million exactly
could be hired, but they would have to be licensed, is what it seems to say.
Thank you.
All right. Unfortunately, we do not have a quorum. It seems a relatively simple bill, but we'll set it aside then and come back to it at a later date. So thank you very much for your testimony. We'll close the public hearing. Senate Bill 194. We'll move to a... by the way, Senate Bill 475 is being set over to another date. So the individuals who want to testify on that bill can go ahead and leave. Let me see. Where's my next bill? We're going to do a public hearing on Senate Bill 743. We have Tim Crawl signed up. Would you like to come up, Tim? Mm-hmm. How are you today?
Fine, Senator. Thank you. Chair Minnis, members of the committee, I'm Tim Krull. I am the executive director of the Oregon Rehabilitation Association. Our members are nonprofits that serve people with disabilities in the community. All of you in your constituent areas have programs of ours: St. Vincent de Paul, East Cove, Walton Valley Workshop, Edwards Center, etc. We strongly support this bill. One of our major problems on fixed state rates for serving these individuals is how to cope with rising costs in insurance. In the developmental disabilities arena, the other payroll expense rates are fixed at 21%. This bill, by covering tort liability, would allow us to reduce our insurance costs. 21% for other payroll expenses compares to what the state allows itself in the 40% range. Just to cover mandatory FICA, unemployment, workers' comp, et cetera, is about 12%. To cover replacement costs, because these are 24/7 operations, people with disabilities who need support full-time, when an individual is gone, we have to replace them. That gets us over the 21% before we even offer health care or any other benefits. We appreciate Senator Minnis introducing this bill, and we believe it's sound state policy. These people are wards of the state. If we didn't exist, the state would have to care for them. They've closed all the state institutions. They have no place to go, and the nonprofit community is the best alternative. I think the bill is fairly straightforward, and we strongly support it.
Mr. Krull, thank you for your testimony, and I apologize for not recognizing my own bill, but for the committee, this bill originated as an idea from testimony in the Senate Health Policy Committee when we heard testimony that liability insurance is becoming more difficult for many of the I guess, agents of the state who care for individuals who wouldn't otherwise be cared for in the community. And we do currently cover the liability of individuals in certain PSRB homes, community-based homes. I just sent Mr. Joseph off to get a copy of the fiscal analysis done by DAS, because DAS would be the entity that holds would actually indemnify and do the actuarial studies with respect to the cost that the committee will have. That it looks like it's coming in at about $100,000 or something. It's over the $50,000 limit, so my assumption would probably have to go to Ways and Means. We do have another person here from Frank Moore from the Office of Mental Health and Addiction Services who's testifying. Will be testifying, I guess, and I'd like to hear what he has to say, why he does not support the bill. So, all right, thank you, Mr. Krull. Appreciate it. Mr. Moore.
Good morning.
Good morning, sir.
Chair Minnis and members of the committee, my name is Frank Moore. I'm the system planner for the Office of Mental Health and Addiction Services.
I'm sorry, you are?
I'm the system planner for the Office of Mental Health and Addiction Services.
Assistant planner. Thank you.
Yeah. I'm here today to provide information on Senate Bill 743. While we believe the bill is good policy, since it's not in the governor's balanced budget, the department cannot support the bill. As you're aware, the bill provides or extends tort liability coverage to any private community provider or a provider that subcontracts in a community mental health program. Okay. Current coverage, as you mentioned earlier, is afforded through to Psychiatric Security Review Board providers only at this time. There's a lot of detail in terms of the coverage, and since I think the coverage is provided as self-insurance by the state of Oregon, and there's the limitations noted in my written testimony. I'll read through those if you want, but
Actually, Mr. Moore, I appreciate your testimony. You've made it clear that at least your organization believes it's good policy, but it isn't in the governor's budget. That's a standard response. So I do appreciate that.
I think on the back half of the page, when we took a look at the number of providers that would be covered, if we look at the Office of Mental Health and Addiction Services, ranging from outpatient providers to those who provide acute care in an inpatient setting, it's 497. I talked to Jack Morgan at the Developmental Disabilities Program, and they put their numbers at 890 providers. There has not been any litigation under the tort liability limitation for Psychiatric Security Review Board since the case against Providence Medical Center in 1988, which makes it obviously, at least for the department standpoint, difficult to estimate a fiscal impact. So, and we're certainly empathetic with providers in terms of their ability to not gain liability insurance due to the increasing costs.
All right. Well, thank you very much. So I think for the committee, some of the testimony we've heard in health policy was that the insurance premiums, like so many in other areas of business, are increasing. And the thought here was that if the state can indemnify these groups, we might be able to keep some of these marginal nonprofits operating as opposed to closing down when we end up suffering some of the net negative result from the closure of these programs. So that's the origin of the bill. Thank you, Mr. Mayor.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Appreciate that. And now we'll shift. I'm going to close the public hearing on this bill, whichever bill it was I'm looking at.
743.
We'll come back to that. And we'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 475. And, committee, this is one we intend to spend a little bit more time talking about. And who's first up here?
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, sir.
I think we're moving 475.
I'm sorry. Did I say 475?
Yes.
497. Excuse me.
Thank you.
Forgive me, please. I'm cooking too fast here today. I'm basting. Okay. Public hearing. 497. Senator Frank Morris, thank you for being patient. Senate Judiciary Committee can be somewhat of a menagerie from time to time, but it's usually my fault.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Frank Morris. Can you hear me okay and get the recording without the microphone?
We can, but it would be appropriate for you to try to speak up because I am admonished again frequently for speaking up.
I'll try to get into the microphone here. I have with me today a panel of presenters. With me right now are four physicians, Dr. Deborah Johnson and Dr. John Satinspiel from Salem, Dr. Thomas Clark, and Dr. Bob Poole from Corvallis. Actually, Dr. Poole is a member of the Corvallis Clinic, and Dr. Tom Clark is a member of Samaritan Health Physicians. I come today with several hats. One is as a senator, the sponsor of this bill, Senate Bill 497. I also come as a member of the Samaritan Health Services Governing Board, the parent board. Samaritan Health Services is an organization that employs approximately 4,100 people that serves the Mid-Willamette Valley of Lebanon, Sweet Home, Albany, Corvallis, and the coastal communities of Newport and Lincoln City. We have also on our panel that I'll be bringing up after the doctors have shared their personal experiences will be Larry Mullins, the Chief Executive Officer of Samaritan Health Services, and Jim Dorrigan of Northwest Physicians Mutual, the insurance company that insures most of the doctors in our state. I have had a long-standing concern about health care, and it has been a motivation for me in my involvement in the governance part of health care, starting out with the Albany First Care Physicians, later merging, assisting in that merger with the Samaritan Health Organization. But my concern has been the unsustainable cost increases that we have experienced as purchasers. I'd like to point out some information that I think puts this in perspective. In 1980, healthcare costs represented 9% of the gross domestic product. In 2000, they were 13%, and as of today, the last calculation, they represented 14.1% of the gross domestic product, and projected to be 16.5% by 2010. One of the concerns that I have is how do we, as consumers, and how do we in our system, how do we accommodate these what I consider to be unsustainable increases? One of the major components, I believe, of this cost increase rise is the issue of utilization. And doctors can talk to you about and share with you the relationship between defensive medicine and utilization. And I've heard numbers as high as 25% of the cost of health care is driven by the defensive strategies that doctors employ. And that's a cost that we need, as a matter of public policy, that we need to be conscious of. In addition to Senate Bill 497, I've introduced Senate Joint Resolution 2 and Senate Bill 93. And those two bills have yet to appear on your calendar. Senate Joint Resolution 2 will focus on medical providers, and it will amend the Constitution to allow the legislature to establish non-economic damage caps through Senate Bill 93. There are actually four legs to this issue, three of which get a lot of press. The most obvious is the medical side, the issues of access, defensive medicine, and recruitment, and you'll hear about those issues from our doctors. The second leg that's quite obvious is the legal community, representing those that are seeking redress for damages that they have sustained, and also representing their own self-interests. You have then the insurance companies, and the insurance company seems to be the one that is blamed for this problem, along with malpracticing physicians. And the accusations against the insurance company is that they're mismanaged, they're greedy, they've lost money in the stock market, they're making it up by rates. You'll be able to hear that story from Northwest Physicians Mutual, which is a physician-owned organization. And the fourth leg that's less obvious in this equation is the impacts on our economy and the economic recovery of this state. And I have some very grave concerns about what is happening. You know, we've been on the headline for Doonesbury with our schools and failing schools, national attention. What we don't need in this state is another Doonesbury about how Oregon is underserving its population with medicine and access to medicine. Solutions to this issue must be found. It's not acceptable the direction that we're going. You know, I think there's a very true analogy as the canary that used to be carried into the coal mine. And when the canary would sing, imminent danger was on the horizon, and it was time to evacuate. Well, the canary is singing in the medical community, and you'll hear that from the doctors today. So I would invite you to listen carefully to their testimony, to the testimony of Larry Mullins and from Jim Dorrigan about this issue.
Before you transition for the committee, I want them to understand that I did ask you and your organization to come in and try to lay a foundation for some of the issues in general. So this is by design. Okay. Thank you. Doctor.
Thank you. Chair Minnis, members of the committee, my name is John Satinspiel, and I am a family physician who practices here in Salem. I do the full spectrum of family practice care, and I do deliver babies, which puts me right on the cutting edge of what's going on here. I think this is a very important issue in terms of access to care in this community and actually throughout the entire state. We are having a tremendous crisis. If I talk to my colleagues, they all agree that it is getting harder and harder to practice medicine in the state of Oregon, that the burdens that we are having to bear are becoming almost overwhelming. I think it's really important, this particular bill, Senate Bill 497, because what it does is it helps to remove the concerns, the issues of medical malpractice from underneath the tort system. And I think that while there may be some arguments about why we should keep med-mal within the tort system, I think there are even more powerful arguments why it doesn't belong there. I am not a nail gun manufacturer. The kind of relationships that I have with my patients are not the same as the kind of relationships that those manufacturers of products have with their customers. The relationships that I have with my patients are built on very powerful emotional and intellectual ties, that when you have a mistake, which is inevitable in my system, a manufacturer can develop a practically foolproof product, and they are expected to do so. I cannot deliver perfect medical care. It will never happen. There are mistakes that are going to be made. There are outcomes that will be bad even when mistakes are not made. And to take those mistakes and to drag them into a system that is designed as the tort system is actually, in my mind, bad public policy. Because in order to adjudicate those mistakes, in many cases, what happens is the trial goes on and on, and the focus becomes the lack of care, the lack of compassion, my inability to keep my patient's best interests at heart. And I guarantee you that that doesn't happen, except perhaps in very, very rare instances. The system, however, encourages that be an issue constantly and virtually any time there is a trial for large damages. The incentive is to do that. The impact is to literally tear the heart out of what I have to bring to the services that I provide to my patients and any healthcare worker has to bring. So from that standpoint, I think it's very important that we take a look at what is really going on in medicine. Does it really belong in the tort system? Is that really the way to address the very real injuries that patients do sometimes incur and the very real motivations and the very real approaches that physicians bring to the care that they provide to their patients? I see this bill as being important because it will do that. It will take at least that particular issue from outside the issue of pain and suffering damages from out of the tort system, and it will put it into a system where we can actually begin to work with it, look at the issues, and address them in a way that is not going to be destructive to the physicians of this state. What happens as a consequence of this is that we do practice defensively. And it's one part because we don't want to be sued. Nobody wants to be sued. But it's another major part because the impact of being sued is so destructive. To what if I were to be sued and I were sitting in court being attacked in that fashion, it is like attacking the very core of who I am and why I went into medicine. I don't believe that it's good public policy to endorse a system that encourages that type of behavior in a courtroom. Thank you.
Thank you, Doctor. Who's next?
I guess I'm next. Chairman Minnis and members of the committee, I'm Tom Clark. I'm an internist from Albany, Oregon. I practiced there 26 and a half years. My father was a physician in Austin, Texas, and I trained in Texas and moved here with my two best friends to set up practice 26 and a half years ago. And I still love medicine. The problems that I see is that people are complaining more and more. And it's the first time I've come to a committee meeting like this. I'm not the kind of person that does that. I'd rather be seeing patients in the office or in the hospital. That's really what I'm better at than trying to figure out what legislation ought to be. But it is a problem right now. And we see the cost of medicine rising, and we go, how come? I mean, in our system, I work for Samaritan, and our system, our malpractice tripled, 800,000 to 3.2 million this year. Gee, how are we going to make that up? Well, you make that up by doing one of two things. Either you pay people less, which you say, the union people, they don't want to be paid less. Most of the doctors don't, because this state, if you look, Medicare pays these doctors less than almost any state in the United States. And so where are you going to get the money, so that you can recruit more physicians? Well, you'll have to at least keep paying them and paying the workers. And so what are you going to do? You're going to not buy updated equipment. So then we'll get, our equipment will kind of go downhill. Does that mean that our CAT scanner and the programs for the MRIs won't be upgraded? Yes, and that's a problem. And it's a problem for everybody in the future. We're still going to order tests. It's in the best interest of our patients, and that's what we want. We do practice defensive medicine. Somebody's hostile to me, says I have a headache and I'm really worried and you better do something, they're going to get an MRI scan very quickly. Because I know that person that's hostile, that maybe I just met in the emergency room and isn't a long-term established patient that I have rapport with, I'm going to order that test. And that's a cost to the system. Whereas if it's somebody I know, I can say, look, why don't we wait a month or two? And they say, well, what happens if I have a brain tumor that kills me in 2 months? I go, it doesn't matter. You're dead.
I mean, there are tumors that people get, and they're going to die, and it doesn't matter. But you can bring somebody in from outside that'll say, I'm Dr. So-and-so, I'm a neurosurgeon, and I don't work anymore because I can make more money going to court. And you think that's a joke, but really, that happened to me. I've been sued once. I won. But it really was devastating to me because my wife died during that suit, and it really upset me. The thing that I see is that you see these lawsuits, and you say, is it right, is it wrong, how much? But it's a cost to the system. And if you're going to say there ought to be whatever some jury decides, and they say, gee, this is a rich insurance company, let's take $5 million from them. That's a cost to the system. And that's okay, but it has to be discussed, and we have to accept the fact that that is a cost. You know, and that's probably my biggest thing that bothers me is I watched that part that we all watched on the Duke case where there's an ABO mismatch, and we go, that's a no-brainer. That's malpractice. And I listened to a trial attorney say, or personal injury attorney say, no good personal injury attorney would take this case for $250,000 pain and suffering because there are no economic damages in this little girl. He said, you know, because that'd be settled out of court. $250,000, he'd get $80,000. And I thought, gee, what happens if I take care of somebody in the middle of the night and save their life? I get a few hundred dollars. You know, I don't get $80,000. There's some disconnect here. I don't get it. And maybe I just don't understand the system. And I say, gee, this is a system. This is the way it's always been. This is the only way we can do it. You know. And then people say, well, how do we get rid of those bad doctors? It's really difficult. Look what happened in Astoria 20 years ago in this state. What happened? We had a bad doctor who basically got sued 4 times, so they took away his privileges, and he sued all the doctors. He took away his privileges because they didn't follow the letter of the law, supposedly. And he took them to court, and basically the court said, we're not looking at malpractice. We're looking at restraint of trade. We don't look at everything. We just look at this little thing. So they gave him a $3.2 million settlement, and it broke a whole bunch of doctors. And the ones that were there left. And you go, that's really harmful to a community. You know, you have something set up. If you really want to get rid of bad doctors, why don't you have 3 strikes and you're out? You lose 3 lawsuits. You lose your license, or you have to go back and train. I wouldn't mind that. But if you're going to do that, I want to be sued in my town. Okay? When I got sued, it was in Multnomah County. How come? Well, my attorney said, well, because that's where the highest amount of payments come from. They don't want to do it in Albany. We try to get change of venue. It happened in Albany. Everything happened in Albany. Why was it in Multnomah County? Because that's where the money is. And that's really what it comes down to. And that's really bothersome to me. You know, that's why you need a cap on this. And the other final point I'll make is, if you don't do something now by not acting on this, and you let it happen, we're not going to recruit subspecialists to this state. What's going to happen is you're going to have a dearth of people. And one of them may be an OB-GYN doctor. And I got 2 daughters, and I'm going, gee, I don't know if I want y'all to stay in this state. I think maybe y'all go somewhere else because you get pregnant. You may not have an OB-GYN doctor. You may have to drive 100, 200 miles. Now, what happens if you're having a complication while that driving occurs and that woman and that child dies? Maybe that would be in 10 years if we do nothing. And if that happens, I can see the news. How could we let this happen? How could doctors let this happen? And, you know, nobody's going to stand up and say, I was on that committee and I decided against tort reform and this is where it led. I hope you'll do that. I hope you'll stand up and say, you know, this is why we didn't want tort reform. I mean, you know, there's a real problem out there. There really is. And there's a cost to the system. And we're going to have to pay for it one way or the other. And if malpractice costs keep going up, you're going to pay for it by not having enough physicians in this state, number one, and number two. The equipment isn't going to be as good. So you're going to want to go to California and get your care. That's all I have to say.
All right, Doctor. Thank you very much for your testimony. I appreciate it. Now, who is next?
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Dr. Deborah Johnson, and I appreciate the opportunity to speak to you this morning. I'm an obstetrician gynecologist. I've been in Oregon for 12 years, and as of January 4th, I'm practicing gynecology only and giving up the obstetric portion of my practice. The decision to no longer practice obstetrics was not arrived at without much agonizing, but ultimately the local litigation climate resulted in 300% rise in malpractice premiums has forced me to make this decision. I shared more than a few tears with my patients when I had to tell them that I could no longer care for them while pregnant. And I'm here to make a plea for common sense. Without reasonable changes in current legislation, women's access to obstetric care will become critically compromised. Already we're seeing real and significant changes in local access to obstetric care. In the past several years, Salem has lost no fewer than 9 obstetricians through retirement, death, change of practice emphasis, and moving from the state. And we have been unable to completely replace these losses. Now recruitment efforts are mortally compromised by our litigation climate and failure to cap awards on non-economic damages. Physicians will not come here. The word is out. My staff and I see results of our having fewer local OBs every day. Where I formerly accepted maybe 3 to 4 patients a week for OB care, most of the patients who call in a given week, I'm now getting 80 to 100 calls a month from women who are unable to find an obstetrician. I really think it does no good to point fingers at who we think is most responsible. The problem is obviously complex with all players taking a part, but the solution could be simple. To protect patients by continuing to cover medical, economic damages, and protect our providers by limiting awards on non-economic damages. Despite what the current climate would have us believe, it has never been safer to have a baby. But it won't remain that way if women's access to prenatal care and deliveries by qualified providers is crippled by their absence in the state.
Thank you, Doctor. Appreciate your testimony.
Mr. Chair, if I might have your indulgence for a couple more comments. I think that my initial comments were focused, I think, on the impact of the tort system and the importance of removing Med-Mal from the tort system. But Senator Morris also made comments about the economic impact of lack of medical care, and Dr. Johnson has just commented, I think, powerfully on the problems with access to obstetrical care. And I would put to the committee, as they look at this issue and begin to address it, the situation in John Day, Oregon, where the family physicians who practice there have stopped doing obstetrics as well. And they stopped doing it specifically because they could no longer afford the liability coverage. It was too expensive, given their practice setting and the economics of their community. Now, if I'm a company and I'm looking to locate in Oregon, and John Day would love to have me, they have resources, they have workers, they have the things that I want, and I find out that they have no obstetrical services to provide to the families of my employees, am I going to want to locate in that community? Is that going to be a place that I'm even going to consider, or am I going to go 60 miles down the road to a community that does have adequate medical services available? This is a very real problem. This is happening now. And we are seeing the first signs of it in our rural areas, but we're also seeing it in Salem. The 80 calls a day that Dr. Johnson, or 80 calls a month that Dr. Johnson is getting in her office, I am also getting in my office. And I'm having to turn people away because I can't do the number of deliveries that are required in this community. It is impossible for me to meet the need because I can't afford it. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Sir?
Good morning, Chair Minnis and members of this committee. I'm Dr. Robert Poole, and I practice urology at the Corvallis Clinic in Corvallis, Oregon. I thank you all for this opportunity to talk to you this morning about the need for medical and liability reform in the state of Oregon. This legislation, Senate Bill 497, does provide a start to provide a change to the legal climate that has brought us to this medical liability, and access problem. The crisis has come to our practice personally in the fact that we've lost, when I came to Corvallis in 1979, I was a third urologist. We've lost two of the urologists since that time. We're back down to three. As you know, the population is much larger, much older, and our area of referral is much bigger. This is inadequate. This has resulted in a major access. My next appointment for routine urologic care is in September. We have been actively recruiting for almost 3 years and have had no active candidates other than one who pulled out last November after she was signed a contract and totally scheduled because of the medical liability problems. Physicians across the country look at Oregon as, these are colleagues, as Oregon being physician unfriendly. This is due to many factors, not just the medical liability issues. Oregon, Corvallis, Portland has 110% the cost of living, the rest of the nation. Overhead in offices has gone up over 23% in the last 5 years. Physicians' payrolls have been flat to declining for the last 10 years. And a good part of this is the lack of tort reform. As has already been brought about, especially by Tom, somebody, not only do they have to pay premiums that this year range from 300% to an average of 50 to 57% alone increase, but to face a malpractice suit for a physician is crushing, both psychologically, emotionally, and economically. And physicians do not want to come to this state. Also compounding this is the fact that specialty training, sometime over the last 10, 15 years ago, there was a manpower study done nationwide that said because of HMOs and because of the gatekeeper concept and such, we won't need so many specialists. So the specialty training programs all cut back nationwide. OHSU Department of Urology trains one-third less urologists. That means that one-third less are coming out every year. Urologists, I'm the third oldest practicing surgeon in Corvallis, and physicians my age, in their late 50s, early 60s, are burnt out. They are tired of spending 2 hours a day, which is the national average for paperwork, to document, to code, to prevent and provide defensive medicine, and so they're leaving the practice. The last urologic publication stated 30% of urologists were retiring in the next 2 years because of medical malpractice alone. One of my junior residents in training is now the medical staff head at Cleveland Clinic. When he was out to talk about from the practice of medicine to the economics of medicine last fall, described recruiting as abominable, and that the only thing that is making it from the more major crisis that it already is the stock market, and that it's gone down for all of us in this room, and that if that ever corrects, that you'll see even more of a flight for retirement. The average urology resident coming out of OHSU has $190,000 in debt. When they come to Corvallis, they're usually married. They have maybe had a house or been in an apartment. They're 32 to 34 years old. They want to buy their first house. There's no way that the Corvallis Clinic can offer them enough income to service that $190,000 debt and buy a home. And they've watched their colleagues, or their non-colleagues, their friends that have gone through college 14 years later buying homes, and they're not willing to defer this. It is now, at least every other patient or more ask me, why is access so difficult? I've explained things I explained to you. I hand them some brochures and statements. We are on physician shortage in the country and the liability problems. And I say the one thing that I can think of that you can do now that can help, because there's so many issues. We can't automatically increase Medicare payments that don't even pay for our overhead now. But we can get tort reform in this state. This is a flyer that I get. I get flyers four or five every week trying to pull me out of Oregon. And it's now a recruiting tool. You can see it probably from where all you sit. Top of the thing in capital letters, tort reform state. That is a recruiting tool that they're using to try and pull doctors out of Oregon.
Would you mind if I got a copy of that?
Certainly.
We'll make copies.
And the last, for those of you that have not seen the Register Guard, yesterday morning, the front page, along with Saddam, talks about the 40-year-old neurosurgeon in Eugene who's moving to Idaho just for those reasons. We are losing the best and the brightest and the youngest, and we can't replace them. And I can tell you, I'm living with this every day, and by the time of the end of the day, I'm an hour behind, more than I would have been, because I'm talking to patients about this. But we need help from you folks, because access is a problem and availability is a problem, and I too have a grandson that's going to be delivered in June, and I hope that my daughter will find medical care for that. Thank you.
All right, thank you very much, Senator Morse.
Are there any questions of the panel?
There may be a few. Senator Ringo.
Thank you. Thanks for coming this morning and welcoming your testimony. Wanted to especially welcome Dr. Poole, who is a neighbor where I grew up. From my perspective, there's no question that our state has a serious problem in terms of delivering medical care, particularly in certain specialties like obstetrics, and particularly in certain communities in the rural areas of our state. And the really difficult question is, what do we do about it? And tort caps are often offered as the solution. I mean, from what I heard on the panel is I think there's been a dramatic change in the practice of medicine over the last 10 or 20 years for lots of reasons that have made it a less attractive profession. And tort reform is not the answer to 90% of those factors. And so it's offered as a solution. And I understand it would address part of the concern, but my sense is that there would still be a lot of these unpleasant factors impacting our practices. One solution that I've talked about with a number of my colleagues here is whether Oregon cannot implement a self-insurance program. Because I completely acknowledge the problem that you described. And in looking for a solution, I think we do need to get creative. You know, Oregon's lawyers self-insure under a very successful program. Now, would that work for the medical profession? And I spoke with Mr. Gowan about this, and he just assures me offhand, no, it wouldn't. But it doesn't seem to me that there's been a willingness from the medical community to really explore that. And I've sent several letters to Mr. Gowan asking for specific information as to whether that isn't worth pursuing. And I really don't get the data back from him.
So what you're saying is you think that a neurosurgeon and a pediatrician ought to pay the same amount. Is that's what you do, right, as far as attorneys? Isn't that right?
I think that we...
But isn't that right? That's what you do in your attorney thing, isn't it?
I'm not saying anything about a neurosurgeon or a psychiatrist pays $1,400 a year, and an OB probably pays how much? $50,000 a year? How much do you pay? $60,000 a year? I'm not saying they should all be pegged equally. All I'm saying is that the refusal to have the discussion is taking a potential solution off the table.
But how do you solve it?
Hold on. I gotta give you guys a little lesson in legislative politics.
Mr. Chair,
protocol.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Your responses to members' questions go through the chair, Mr. Chair, and then the member. And the only reason we do that is to try to maintain some semblance of order here. It's somewhat difficult to do, but if you don't mind, okay. Who wants to speak? Go ahead, sir, then.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. Senator Ringo, I appreciate your question. And I've heard the self-insurance balloon floated before. I would point out to you that 60% of the physicians in this country are covered by physician-owned insurance companies. We have our own physician-owned mutual insurance company here in Oregon, Northwest Physician. They are being hit as hard, if not harder. You will be hearing from Jim Dorgan, who is a representative of that company. To suppose that somehow or other by setting up some PLC-type program that, you know, is going to be able to do the job. The question that you ask implies that somehow there can be a program, perhaps, that would do the job better than Northwest Physicians. It is a mutual insurance company. They do not pay dividends. Their only goal is to provide insurance from physicians, by physicians, and for physicians. We have self-insurance, and it's not working.
Doctor, all I'm asking for is to be able to look at that data. Now, is that not reasonable?
I think it's perfectly reasonable.
Okay. That's all I want to see is the information so that I know where the money is going. And I've asked for that on two separate occasions, and I haven't received it.
Okay. I understand that Mr. Dorgan's on your on our schedule today, and I hope he will be able to give you some of that information.
Right, and I hope he doesn't make a superficial argument that says we're self-insurance, therefore it doesn't work. I want to see the data. Is that reasonable?
You've already heard me agree to that.
Okay, thank you. I guess the other thing, Doctor, is I, as a trial lawyer, I have seen the legal arena from lots of angles, and I guarantee you that nobody likes being sued, but there's a question in our society as to whether we're going to hold people accountable or not. You know, and the chair of our committee, John Minnis, is a police officer, and if he violates the professional standards of care of law enforcement, he's going to be held accountable. And lawyers are, and accountants are, and engineers are, architects. Every profession is held accountable. And so when I hear you say, boy, we just find it destructive to be sued, it's hard for me to respond to that and say, okay, you want a free pass, but we're going to hold everybody else accountable.
Mr. Chair, I don't know, and members.
Yeah, go ahead.
You know, I understand what you're saying about that. We're not asking to be not.
Senator Ringo, we reminded the panel, and I need to remind my fellow committee members that questions as well go through the chair.
Thank you.
Yeah, that's right. I didn't know who the chair.
I'm the chair.
Vice chair.
She's the chair.
Senator Burdick. We're not asking not to be held accountable. You've heard, we've got our Board of Medical Examiners that has been publicly, you know, I see names every month or quarter of these coming out. These suits are going to happen. There are a few things, but we can't provide perfect medicine. And, again, it's one thing to be held accountable. It's another thing to go and have these huge judgments that the law profession takes whatever percent, 40%, that doesn't go to the patient, and $20 million doesn't make a lot of sense. There's accountability and there's excess, and it's the excess, and we're willing to work with what's fair. Arbitration, which I know, you know, attorneys, then it can always go to, but it doesn't have to go to these shows and cost us $100,000 to $125,000 to win. And the crushing, I mean, I've never been sued. And I hope to heck I never am. I can guarantee the first time I am, I know I lost my mother 1 hour ago or 3 hours ago, and I'm a very emotional person. I've had tears all week. I know that first lawsuit is going to devastate me, and I will be out of medicine.
Madam Chair. Thank you. Yes.
We could debate this all day long, and I know there's other witnesses and other members of the committee who have questions. I guess I just want to reiterate, this is a huge problem for our state. I mean, I would want to be very active in helping address that, because I have an interest in seeing people provided medical care, including my family. And I would want to work with you in finding a solution on that.
We had a comment.
Yes, Senator Burdick and Senator Ringo. I think the accountability issue is very important, and this is not about trying to avoid accountability. But the system by which we are trying to assign and assess a value for injuries and damages is not working. It is destructive. It is destroying the relationships that we as physicians and healthcare workers, nurses and others included, it's destroying the relationships that we need to have with our patients. It is not acting in the best interests of our patients. There are plenty of patients, and the example was brought forward about an attorney who would not take a case because it's not worth $250,000. There's not enough money in it for them. There are patients now who have suffered real damages who are unable to access the legal system because their damages aren't great enough. So the accountability system isn't working. The tort system as it's currently constructed is not acting in the public interest. And we're not asking as physicians to escape accountability, but what we're asking for is what we're requesting is a system that really will reflect what is in the best public interest. The current system isn't.
Madam Chair?
Yes,
I mean, just to respond to that briefly, I mean, one of the problems with bringing, I mean, from a plaintiff's point of view, is bringing a medical malpractice case is so expensive because the defense never admits fault, and they'll pour so much money into defending a lawsuit. And that's why for a medical malpractice mistake where the damages are less than catastrophic, you can't bring an action because it costs too expensive. I mean, if a surgeon makes a mistake and they leave an object, a sponge or something, in the abdominal cavity during surgery and causes an infection and okay, you have to take it out a week later and the person missed 3 weeks worth of work and they had a serious infection, but it all worked out okay in the long run, there's no recourse. Absolutely not, because it's too expensive to bring that lawsuit. And so when you say that the accountability system isn't working, you're right. You're right.
Thank you, Senator Inger. Other members, but Senator Walker.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just have one question. Dr. Settenspiel, you keep saying that the tort system doesn't work and that you need to be taken out of the tort system. But I've read this bill over and over again, and all this bill does is ask that your patients sign a waiver for non-economic damages. It doesn't really tell me how you're going to be taken out of the tort system because of that. Is there a companion bill here?
The concern that I have, ultimately I would personally like to see medical malpractice taken out of the tort system. What this bill does that is important is it takes the non-economic damages, it puts a contractual cap on that. The area where we run into problems in my opinion, as far as what happens to the system, is that with unlimited liability, with access to unlimited damages, the incentive is to, in a very real sense, cast the healthcare team that came into caring for this patient with all the best intentions, with all of the drivers that brought us into healthcare, our desire to be caring and compassionate and so on. You take that healthcare team, and in order to get that kind of large dollar award damages, Senator Ringo probably can comment to that, you literally need to tear that team apart. You need to tear apart their motivations. One of the examples, just the other day, I was speaking with an obstetrical nurse in Salem, and she was commenting about a deposition that she had to give. And during the course of that deposition, the plaintiff's attorney literally put his face within inches of hers and said, "Now, while you were in the process of executing this patient's death warrant, was there anything else you were thinking about doing?" Defense attorneys will tell you, as egregious as that sounds, that that is not uncommon in these kind of high-dollar cases. The net result of that was a nurse that I know to be incredibly caring, incredibly compassionate, and very highly skilled comes back with the comment that she wishes that that attorney and his family's family from now until the future have to deliver their babies in the deserts of eastern Oregon in a tent without any medical care. I submit to you, when you have a system that will tear somebody's motivation out like that, that will literally rip the heart and soul out of what they bring to medical care services, when you have a system that provides an incentive for that kind of behavior, you have a system that is not acting in the best interest of the public.
Senator Starr.
Thank you, doctors. I'm very, very sympathetic to your testimony this morning. I have watched over many years the litigious character of our society changing. Some years ago, my mother had a knee replacement. Something went wrong, and she suffered for several years. They finally discovered that there was infection inside of the knee. She was treated as a hypochondriac for some time, complaining unnecessarily. But when they opened that up, there was a quart of just corruption inside. left it open 3 months, treated her with intravenous drugs, removed that knee, and she lived 5 years without a knee joint. Got around pretty well. Neither she, my father, or any of the four sons ever thought about a court action. We believe in this life that indeed we will suffer some tribulation, but we're nowhere all perfect, and that we would saddle a profession with such burdens that they can't perform what is best for all of us. And the best way that they can is, to me, just absolute bad policy. I'm going to be very supportive of this bill or anything that takes this out of the tort system. And so I thank you very much for your testimony this morning.
Are there other questions? Thank you, Senator Starr. Are there other questions on this panel? Senator Morris, do you have any concluding remarks?
Thank you, Madam Chair. If there are no further questions, we'd like to invite Jim Dorgan and Larry Mullins to bring forward their testimony.
Okay, thank you very much. Yes, please.
Thank you.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee. If you give your name for the record before you start.
Thank you, Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Larry Mullins. I'm President and Chief Executive Officer of Samaritan Health Services. Samaritan Health Services is an integrated delivery network with five hospitals and approximately 600 employed physicians that provides care and service to communities from the coast to the Cascades. Our hospitals serve communities ranging in size from 15,000 people to 75,000 people, so we see a very broad range of community care needs and requirements. We have over 600 physicians and allied health practitioners who provide service at those hospitals. The item I'd like to talk to you about this morning is in support of this bill, and predominantly because of the communities we serve are facing a crisis in terms of their medical care capabilities. We face this crisis today, not in the future, but now. What I would like to do is depart somewhat from my prepared remarks, because I think some of those items have been covered by prior speakers, and perhaps talk to an item or two that was raised by the committee members and just share some personal perspective with you. I think the comment was made that sometimes we're like canaries in the cave, that when the canaries start having difficulties, we know that the oxygen is not sufficient enough to sustain us. And as a hospital executive, I kind of feel like that canary, that I'm seeing a lot of activity go around, and I don't necessarily want to point in one direction or another and say this is right or this is wrong. But what I can say is that we do have significant problems in the delivery of our health care, and that if we don't fundamentally change the healthcare delivery system and related items to it, I'm not sure how sustainable our healthcare delivery is for the future. I think we're at a point in time that we're almost into an early warning system type of mode, that we're seeing a lot of activities that are happening, and it's a culmination of events that are occurring both from reimbursement, from budgetary impact issues, from labor costs, from technology costs, and from malpractice and legal-related costs. Now, one of the questions that was raised earlier, and I think it is a valid point, is whether or not some kind of other approach wouldn't work. And I guess in my mind, I would welcome any approach that would actually mitigate the cost of healthcare delivery, because that's the primary pressure of the healthcare executive that I feel is from the public about what are we doing about healthcare costs. And as I said to a reporter the other day, healthcare costs are not an isolated item. They're part of the economy overall, so we're impacted by all costs. And one of the things we are looking at is a captive insurance company, similar to what was perhaps suggested earlier about a pooled fund. And I'm hopeful that maybe that might mitigate the cost issues. But I do need to report to the committee that one of the issues that we've encountered because of the environment we're in is that it's almost impossible to obtain our excess coverage. In other words, the amount of limits of coverage that we would require in addition to those amounts that we're willing to take the first dollar risk on. And to give you a perspective on that, we're willing to take the first $1 million of risk. So what I'm looking for is excess coverage beyond the $1 million up to, say, $10 or $20 million. And right now, it is very, very difficult to obtain that, almost to the point that it's cost prohibitive. And in some cases, with some physicians, I can't get it at all. And I think the issue in my mind is not what the cost will be for health care, but literally, will we be able to provide health care if we don't fundamentally change some of the dynamics? And I'm literally seeing that start to play out in different communities to where either I can't get coverage for certain types of programs or certain types of physicians, or I can't recruit physicians to those communities for certain types of programs as well. And mainly speaking, it relates to a lot of the specialty areas, but I'm even seeing this start to impact, say, family practitioners that have obstetrical privileges or deliver babies, to the point that we're looking at whether or not we should even continue those programs in certain communities just because we don't know if they're sustainable, again, from a program basis. When I meet with people in those communities, they tell me, how can I even remotely consider doing that? How could we possibly suggest that we're not going to have a certain type of service available to them? So I do want you to appreciate, this is not necessarily, in my mind, trying to place blame in one arena or another, but it's rather a recognition that we really do have a very serious problem that we have to be proactive about, or we're going to have unintended consequences that are really going to affect the very ability to deliver health care in Oregon. Now, related to this is the fact that there should be accountability, and I would be one of the first to agree there needs to be strong accountability. And that does need to occur in some type of a peer review process to where there's full disclosure and discovery and consequences for the actions that occur. My own sense of it, though, is that if you really want that to occur in an environment, you have to make that environment as risk-free for the reporting of that information. It's one of the reasons we have the kind of peer review statutes that we do. And again, one of the other things I observe is that early observer of events is more and more difficulty getting people to be forthcoming in their items because of the environment that we're in and their fears that relate to that. I'm not opposed to a system that keeps people whole. I think we should keep them whole. But I'm worried about having services available that can keep them whole in the first instance from a physical and care perspective. So again, it's the unintended consequences that I worry about in terms of our public policy. It's the long-term effects of will we be able to provide health care on the basis that the citizens of Oregon desire to have it. And this bill at least starts to move us in the right direction of trying to reduce some of that risk element so that we can get higher accountability, but also so that we can control costs, which the public tells us is one of their major concerns for the future. So, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for your time. I appreciate the opportunity to be here this morning. If there's any questions, we'd be happy to answer them.
Questions, Senator Ringo?
Thank you. Thanks for coming this morning, Larry. I am interested in what should the legislature do to explore peer review, improving the peer review process in a way so that we can help address physician problems outside of the malpractice arena. What can we do better on that?
I think that's a very good question, Senator and Mr. Chairman, in regards to the fact that the reporting of the events is really important early on if we're going to modify the environment and make sure that accidents don't happen or bad things don't occur again. It's one of the most critical factors. I think the Institute of Medicine report has pointed out is that you have to have early reporting and then follow up to those activities to modify them. One of the ways I think that could be better accomplished is some kind of a hold harmless type of activity that's said to the reporting parties. They're granted some kind of protections in the course of that reporting, something similar to what you see maybe in the aviation industry where pilots can report near misses, but they don't lose their licenses because they report those events or they don't suffer consequences in the legal system as a result of actions by other parties. Other things I think the legislature might consider is granting some kind of dispensation to providers that give care in arenas that they don't absolutely have to, but it's in a public's benefit that they do. The example being the emergency room. one of the most critical issues we have right now is how do we get physicians to continue to take call in the emergency room. This is an issue that exists in every community in Oregon and exists throughout the United States. One of the answers we hear from our physicians when we approach them on this, and most of the times medical staff bylaws require them to do it, is that one of the reasons they're considering not going there is because of the cost of related malpractice. Well, maybe the emergency room could be a risk-free environment to provide that care as an incentive for those practitioners to provide the care in that environment similar to a Good Samaritan Act. And that wasn't just a commercial plug for our organization, but the name is similar. But in any event, I think that the creative ways can be looked at. I think the waiver type approach model is a good step in the right direction because it takes things out of a punitive approach, if you will, into a constructive approach.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. Any other questions? Thank you. Frank, what's next?
Thank you.
Sir?
Thank you. Senator Minnis, members of the committee, thank you very much for inviting me here today. My name is Jim Dorrigan. I'm CEO of Northwest Physicians Mutual. We are a member-owned mutual insurance company domiciled in the state of Oregon. We insure over 2,300 Oregon physicians, which represents about 40% of the market that buys insurance. If I can, I'm not sure if my slide presentation today will work. What I'd like to do today is talk about the symptoms, the causes, and some proposed solutions to the medical malpractice insurance crisis that we see today. The Northwest Physicians Mutual was founded by a group of Salem area physicians in 1983. Currently, over 60% of physicians are insured by provider-owned organizations, either mutual or reciprocals. In 1999, Oregon's cap on non-economic damages was eliminated. Prior to 1999, Northwest Physicians Mutual had seen 10 to 12 very stable years of insurance premium and also losses in the state. What we've seen now in the years 1999 to 2003, we've seen claim payments skyrocket. We've seen premiums for physicians double and triple. And until the system is changed, prices will continue to increase. It's not a matter of funding or setting up another method for funding the losses. It's that the losses need to be paid and they're growing very rapidly. If we had a PLF-type system with all physicians in the system over the last 5 years, physicians would have paid approximately 50% more over that period of time. Currently pending in the state of Oregon, between CNA and Northwest Physicians Mutual, there are $1.5 billion worth of lawsuits. In other words, those are the amount of the prayers in the lawsuits. That's over 4,500. That's for 4,500 doctors. If we were to pay the demands currently in the lawsuits pending, we could do that with an assessment of $334,000 per doctor. The demands are huge. The symptoms that we're seeing in Oregon, the AMA has declared Oregon to be one of 12 states in crisis. We are not in a group of states that we would choose to be included with. Included in the states, the crisis states, are Florida, Georgia, Mississippi, Nevada, New Jersey, New York, Ohio, Pennsylvania, Texas, Washington, and West Virginia. The AMA, American Medical Association, has added six additional states. So the physicians earlier were talking about whether Oregon would be, whether they can recruit doctors to Oregon. Doctors are being actively recruited out of Oregon. Until the climate changes, I think we'll continue to have that problem. Malpractice insurance rates continue to rise, but they're rising for a reason. They're rising to cover the cost of losses. Medical malpractice insurance is different than other lines of insurance for lawyers, for others not in healthcare, because the non-economic damages are a huge portion of the losses. No one in healthcare is debating whether they should pay the economic damages. It's the pain and suffering awards that are the concern. Underwriting is much tighter for doctors coming in. It's difficult for doctors with claims histories and the other problems to obtain insurance. And there's few insurers that will be willing to come into the state. And that includes reinsurers, people that will come in and provide the excess coverage. So it's not a matter of what type of insurance vehicle to use. It's a matter of what can we do to control the losses. The causes, high jury awards and settlements. Prior to 1999, in our first 15 or so years of operation, we had two cases of $1 million or more. Since 1999, we've had, I believe, 15 as of today. So the awards are larger, the settlements are larger, and it's truly impacting the cost. The huge demands in the lawsuits, a major factor, the average obstetrician, if sued today, the demand in the lawsuit is $9.5 million. We recently, last week, got a lawsuit against an obstetrician asking for $27 million. And the majority of those demands are non-economic damages. It's the scare factor. It's the fact that a jury may award that amount. The indemnity payments or the claim payments made by all insurers in the state of Oregon increased fourfold from 1998 to 2001. They increased from $15 million to $60 million. That and that alone is the reason why insurance premiums have risen. If we change
it, say that one more time.
From 1998, indemnity payments paid by all licensed insurers in the state increased from $15 million to over $60 million. That and that alone is the reason that the malpractice premiums have risen. If we have an alternative funding mechanism, whether it be another insurance company, whether it be a self-funded program, the premiums will continue to rise until we get at the core problem of the issues, which are the rising costs.
All right. Senator Walker has a question.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you please explain indemnity payments?
Indemnity payments are the amounts paid to the plaintiffs in the cases. And the other types of payments are loss adjustment expense payments, which are the costs of litigation. So these are payments made to injured parties.
Okay.
Yes, Senator Ringo.
So that includes defense costs?
It does not include defense costs.
Okay.
Defense costs are in addition to that and probably represent, well, let's take, for example, the 2001 year. There were direct premiums collected by all riders in the state of $50,470,000. There were direct losses paid of $60,801,000. In addition to that, there were direct defense costs paid of $10,809,000. And in the direct defense cost category, that includes the costs that can be directly allocated to a case for medical experts, legal defense, and investigation. So the total loss on a cash flow basis before any other expenses for all carriers in 2001 was $21,140,000. And that's why the rates continue to rise.
Further question?
Yes.
Thank you, sir. Could you please tell me what percentage of the cases that are filed you're paying out indemnity payments on? Do you know?
Yes.
What your win-loss ratio is?
On indemnity payments, we pay out on approximately 25% of the cases that are filed.
Okay. Thank you.
Of the cases that are filed, less than 5% go to trial. What we're seeing is that a few large awards tend to drive settlements. So there have been some very large awards in the state. They tend to make the settlement of cases more difficult, and they tend to drive up the cost significantly.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Ringo.
You said less than 5% go to trial. Of the cases that go to trial, what percent are won by the defense?
Traditionally, 80%. Our percentage last year in Oregon, I believe, dropped to 60%. And there's some strong arguments that maybe you need additional screening to keep the 75% of cases out. There's some discussion that those are the frivolous cases that are driving a tremendous amount of cost into the system. But they are very serious cases, and they're very serious for us. We take each case and have to defend it and provide a defense, so it's very costly. On average, it costs us between $15,000 and $20,000 to deal with those cases, to defend them.
Yes, sir. Go ahead.
So your track record is that the defense win 80% of the cases.
About 75%.
75%.
Approximately.
Okay. Thank you.
Of all cases filed.
Counsel has a question.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just following up on Senator Ringo's question, what the 75% of cases that aren't settled don't go to trial, what happens to those cases? They just go away?
Those are either dismissed or not pursued.
Thank you. No other questions? Go ahead. Continue. Just try to speed you up just a little bit and redeem the time.
Five minutes?
That's fine.
Okay.
Yes.
We hear about investment returns being a driver of this situation. That is not the case. In our investment portfolio, less than 10% of our investments are in the stock market. Insurance companies in general invest 80% of their investments in bonds. So what we generally see are lower investment returns than you would in a stock portfolio, but you also have lower volatility. Between 1999 and 2002, our investment returns ranged from 3.6% to 8.8%, and while the S&P during that period of time ranged from minus 11.9% to plus 37.6%. So we may be seeing some lower returns because the bond rates are lower and there are some losses in the stock market, but that's not what's driving the situation. The average indemnity payment that we paid, an indemnity being the amount to an injured party, increased from 1996 to just over $100,000 to 2001 to over $300,000.
What page are you on, by the way? Just
I'm on page 4.
All right.
This
on page 5.
The solutions that I see, the recognition of by the medical profession, legislature, and the public of the problem, I think we're there on that. Implementation of a comprehensive tort reform package, and we've seen that successfully work in other states. Continued focus on patient safety and risk management. We devote over 21% of our budget to physician education and patient safety, and development of a coalition to institute change. The healthcare liability reforms that we feel are effective are the reforms being proposed on a national level and implemented in California, which are known as the micro reforms, the cap on non-economic damages. The bill that we're talking about today would allow the doctors to implement that with their patients on an individual basis. The other bills being considered include collateral source offset, periodic payment of future damages, reduced statute of limitation and modification of joint and several liability and contingency fee rules. Tort reform works. In California, micro reforms have improved the availability and health and affordability of health care. Since 1976, California rates are up 167%, while other states have averaged over 500%. From 1988 to 1998, Oregon rates decreased 50% as a result of the 1987 tort reform measures that were passed in the state. In 2002, rates increased 12 to 15% in states with non-economic damage caps. In 2002, rates increased 44% in states without any non-economic damage caps. We've shown that tort reform works. When in 1987 tort reform was passed, we acted very promptly to reduce rates and kept those rates at a low level. Since the cap was knocked out in 1999, rates have skyrocketed. The impact on the public was well debated today, but their physicians are retiring. We can't recruit new physicians to the state. Availability in certain specialties, and that isn't just obstetrics and it isn't just neurosurgery. It's urologists, it's cardiologists, it's gastroenterologists, it's 6-week waits for referrals. So So I feel that this bill is a part of a package. It is a step for this committee to consider, but I think we need to look at a broad spectrum of reform. Thank you very much.
All right, thank you. I appreciate your comments. Any last questions, Senator Ringo?
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Gordon. As you heard, I am interested in exploring how a self-insurance program would work in Oregon. And when I raise that, I'm often given the example of Northwest Physicians Mutual as the example as to why it wouldn't work. And essentially, it is a mutual program. And it makes me interested in really understanding your financial situation better, and I'm wondering whether you would make your financial records available.
I'd be happy to do that.
Okay.
We've made our financial records available to the governor's task force, and also if you would like to explore the PLF and how that option would work, I'm fairly familiar with that in that I served as a public member on their board of directors for 5 years and chaired their finance committee.
Well, I mean, if you could call me at some point and we could go over that, I would appreciate it.
Okay. The core problem that I see with that, and I think is where the resistance comes, is that the escalating costs are going to need to be paid by the healthcare community. Unless we get at the core of the costs and the escalating verdicts and settlements, that a PLF won't make that go away. It'll just create another fund. And the secondary concern is that it would create a larger, fully accessible fund, and the ability to settle cases would be more difficult.
All right.
Thank you, George.
With respect to your company, your loss reserves, and how are those regulated? I assume through the insurance division.
We're regulated by the Oregon Insurance Division.
And what do you normally set aside as far as loss reserves? Is there a ratio? Or?
This year, it was 98%, I believe, of premiums.
98% of premium.
So we've operated in a loss environment ever since 1999. Since 1999, the principal or the surplus of the company has been reduced from over $30 million to just over $7 million based on this environment. So we've had extreme losses.
So my assumption then is that you are intentionally building up loss reserves. Is that correct?
Well, this is surplus in excess of loss reserves, so it's the cushion that we have in the event that the loss reserves are not enough.
Are not sufficient, okay. Well, I think it would be helpful to have, I guess, some understanding of what you do with the loss reserves, your cushion, your general cash flow.
Okay.
If you're willing to provide that, that
would be very happy to do that.
Could be very profitable. Senator Morse, last remarks.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I do appreciate your interest and time this morning to listen to these issues. They are real. I think without question we have a public policy issue that's affecting our state. It affects us in many, many ways, and I look forward to working with you. I've made the statement that I'm not wedded as a legislator to any one idea. What I'm wedded to is the idea that works and gives us a solution, and it probably isn't just one idea, but the canary is singing, and we need to listen.
All right.
So thank you very much.
Thank you, Senator. I appreciate your time.
I would like to stay for the balance of the hearing, Mr. Chairman, but I do have other comments.
Oh, I was going to say you're welcome to sit up on the panel if you want, but if you've got other hearings.
I do have other comments.
I understand.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
We need you in Ways and Means.
Pardon?
We need you in Ways and Means.
All right. Michael Alexander.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Nick Alexander. I'm a local practitioner. I've been here in the city of Salem for 27 and a half years. My practice is almost exclusively civil litigation and almost exclusively on the plaintiff's side. I'm also the current president of the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association, and I appreciate your willingness to let me testify here today. I have passed out some written testimony about the specifics of the bill, but in light of the testimony offered in terms of the general climate, I would like to do two things. Number one, I hope that you will share the information that has been submitted to your colleagues in the House Last week there were three full days of hearings on the general insurance crisis, and there were two additional days of hearings this week. There was much testimony and much written materials, and I certainly refer you to that testimony to put a broader perspective on this whole idea. I also want to discuss at the beginning the problem facing the doctors, which I am very sympathetic towards in terms of rising insurance rates. And I was very moved by the testimony that the doctors gave before the House Judiciary last week. And I was especially impressed by the interrelationship between the doctors with general practitioners and specialists and how they collectively share the responsibility for delivering care to their patients, and that they are all very interdependent. There was testimony from a doctor, I believe in Reedsport, a general practitioner who delivered babies, who was very concerned because their surgeon had left town and there was no one available to do cesarean sections in case they encountered that problem. And there were similar testimonies from an emergency room physician who indicated that it was very difficult to recruit people to work those long hours and provide that essential care, not only to the patients but to the other doctors in the community. And so I was indeed very struck by this interrelationship and the shared responsibility for delivering care. And part of our discussions, meaning the trial lawyers and others in this case, has been, if you're going to share this responsibility, is there anything really wrong with sharing the risk of the liability insurance? There are some very real statistics and numbers, and I know that statistics and numbers can be at times frightening and if they don't put you to sleep, but there are some basic principles that also apply to insurance, and those principles involve risk spreading. And I think that we can all realize that if you want to have effective insurance, you have to have a pool over which you can spread the risk effectively in case there is any catastrophic losses. That's true for us in homeowners insurance or auto insurance or anything. If we can't spread the risk broadly enough, insurance doesn't make much sense. The medical malpractice arena is one in which insurance is not spread broadly, but is spread very narrowly. The classifications of physicians are getting more and more narrow. And there was information provided to the task force, and I was a member of the governor's task force that looked into this situation, and we met for 4 or 5 months, about once a month last summer and early part of the fall. And I was surprised and somewhat alarmed by the fact that the classifications are getting more and more narrow rather than getting broader. I think there was even testimony that there are three separate classifications for anesthesiologists. We had testimony just, I'm losing track of my days, I think Tuesday in the House about neurosurgeons, and the number of neurosurgeons in the state that were submitted on a little chart was something like 66. You don't have enough of a population to spread the risk. And so I felt again that the idea of a PLF concept where the risk is spread evenly would seem to be a workable solution to the doctor's problems. And I also heard testimony that that was the one solution that the doctors would not consider under any circumstances. And again, these figures troubled me. And then I listened to the actuary who was presented on behalf of CNA Insurance, and she talked about the need to have individual doctors bear the risk of their particular specialties, and she submitted statistics which are available to you. It was written testimony that was presented to the House. And she analyzed the cost of the risks of loss for various physician categories over the last 10 years. And she pointed out that a psychiatrist paid $1,200 per year, a neurosurgeon paid $36,000 per year, and then she said that if you spread the risk evenly among all the groups of physicians, the cost would have been $5,000 per year, or much less than a family spends on health insurance.
Senator Walker has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Alexander, when Mr. Dorgan was testifying, let me see if I can find my notes on that, he said that if they had a PLF model, it would have meant 50% more in premiums in the last 5 years. Can you address that? Did he testify in the House and you heard more significant testimony than we did.
And so Mr. Dorgan and I have testified on a few occasions together, and I try to remember what he said, and I hope I don't misquote him. I didn't hear that before, and I don't know who would have seen the 50% increase. The GPs or the OBs, I don't think the OBs would have seen it. And the fact that these high-risk specialties who are very integral to the delivery of health care by all physicians have to bear an overwhelming brunt of this cost, to me, seems to be inappropriate in light of the necessary services that are being delivered and in light of the very artificial market that physicians have to operate in, meaning that they can't pass their costs on directly to their patients. What they've testified to and what I agree, because there's third-party payers that take that up. So the risk spreading is something that, do we have a solution? And incidentally, I also heard testimony from the mother of a brain-damaged baby and heard her very compelling story, and I'm not going to try to just elicit sympathy, but she was wonderful. And I really think to myself, as our first solution that we talk about to limit the rights of brain-injured children, or do we look at something new, and the figures again of $5,000, and I was asked a question, are you saying that that's what it would cost today? And I said, no, I don't know. I don't know all the figures. I just know what their figures were. And Mr. Dorgan's company in 2001, and the financial statements, incidentally, are available, and I have them in my office of Northwest Physicians. You can get them through the insurance commissioner's office. But in 2001, I believe the losses were $18 million, including $8 million that was paid on one case, $6 million, which was in excess of the policy limits, which means that Northwest mishandled the claim, at least legally speaking, that's why you pay excess, and paid an additional $6 million. And I believe they received $8 million in reinsurance that same year. And on their financial statements, I believe that they showed a loss on their income of $11 million and a negative cash flow of $400,000. And the accounting, and I'm not saying there's anything inappropriate in the accounting procedures. I'm sure that Northwest follows them to the letter. But the accounting procedures in insurance industry are rather different from what you and I might expect on if we're filing our own taxes or filling out income statements. That doesn't mean there weren't losses. But even in their worst year of 2001, if you divided those losses, including the $18 million, the entire amount, among all of their insureds, it would be about $7,500. So I don't see that there's a crisis in terms of the ability to make affordable insurance available to all physicians if all physicians are willing to come together and say, how are we going to fix this, and can we fix it and preserve the rights of our individual patients? I think that access to care and the availability of physicians can certainly be remedied if all the physicians are willing to get together and say, we're going to share this risk, preserve the rights of people, and also preserve the rights and the integrity of our profession. And I would hope that they would be willing to do so. And I'm somewhat concerned that the rejection of a plan for the PLF is almost because of who the messenger is. That I wear such a black hat in the eyes of the medical profession or those in my profession that they won't listen to what we propose, no matter how logical it may seem. If that is the tension that's grown in the scope of the tort system and the difficulties with litigation, it's something that I have to live with, but I hate to think that this body in the state of Oregon has to live with that tension by not reasonably considering other viable alternatives that may exist. And I want to talk...
How about if we combine the PLF with a medical liability fund? We just blend all the physicians and the attorneys together in one fund.
You know, I think it'd be a great idea. The idea is risk spreading. And incidentally, Mr. Dorgan talked about investment losses. And investment losses aren't the only thing that affects the insurance cycle. And Mr. Rosenfield from California testified last week about MICRA, about all of the wonderful California insurance reforms. And if you would have been there and heard this gentleman who has studied it and made it his life's work, he testified quite persuasively that what brought insurance premiums down in California was insurance reform that was enacted in the late 80s as opposed to tort reform that was enacted in the mid-70s. And he had his graphs and charts that showed how medical malpractice insurance premiums increased in the years following tort reform and decreased in the years following insurance reform.
Mr. Alexander, I don't think you want to get me started on some of the issues relevant to the PLF because, quite honestly, they do have some of their own sins with respect to how they have settled cases in the past and some of the legal strategies they've used to cut off plaintiffs who filed practice issues with the PLF. Now, they've resolved some of those issues.
They resolve, Senator Menace, I'm sorry. I agree, and I think that's one of the strong points about the fact that you have a monopoly situation and you have all the lawyers participating and concerned about not only their rates but the way things are handled and concerned about the fact that the PLF is there not only to protect lawyers but to protect the public. And when the PLF engaged in what a lot of lawyers thought were improper claims handling, the lawyers said stop, and the chairman was removed and those tactics ended. And the idea that there's actually a public policy protecting the public component of the PLF is probably unique amongst any insurance company or quasi-insurance company that one can imagine. So, Senator, I'm happy to deal with those sort of issues because we dealt with it internally and took care of that. And I think that that is very important. And we'll deal with it in the future if it were to arise.
And I do agree with you. The bar did take care of that, and they did do a pretty good job of
rectifying
those issues. So.
Also, and I think it was brought up by Senator Walker, I want to talk a little bit about this particular legislation. We've heard a lot about caps. We have never heard about enforcing caps in a relationship of an individual agreement. As you said, Senator Walker, this legislation doesn't take anything out of the tort system. It just limits the rights of injured parties and forces them to enter into a contract. And I say forces them to enter into a contract because can you imagine in this day when you rarely even get to pick your doctor because of insurance limitations on who you can go to, and in this day when if you authorize this legislation, Mr. Dorgan and any other medical malpractice insurer in this state will tell every doctor they insure, you had better get your patients to sign this or we won't insure you. And so the patients will have absolutely no choice in the matter. And you'll have patients, they even talk about in the bill, if the patient is incapacitated, you can get a representative of the patient to sign the waiver. So you have someone being wheeled into an emergency room, unconscious and in a life-threatening situation, and you have the person in the ER looking around for a representative to sign a waiver of your constitutional rights. These types of exculpatory contracts, as I indicate in my written testimony, have been unanimously and uniformly disapproved by every court that I've known that has passed on them, as long as they deal with necessities and they deal with people of unequal bargaining positions.
Senator Walker has another question for Mr.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Alexander, I'm so glad you've addressed this, and I appreciate your written testimony because while I appreciate that we need to be having this conversation about medical malpractice and tort reform as we all talk about it, this bill isn't the way to get there. I'm so glad you're addressing this because your scenario of someone being wheeled into an emergency room and incapacitated, I can imagine my husband standing there and, you know, I'm going in for surgery and he's got to sign this form that says he's going to waive my right to sue should they treat me improperly in the emergency room. What's he going to do? Say no? So I just want to thank you for bringing
Although, that. On that point, I do understand what you're saying with respect to an emergency room situation where there's no choice.
Well,
my insurance company allows me to pick whomever I choose, and I've had no problem choosing a physician. So if I went to my physician under my existing insurance policy. The physician offered me this, and I consciously, knowingly waived my constitutional rights. Tell me why that would be prohibited.
Well, Mr. Chair, in response to your question, also Senator Walker's, because traditionally we've said that prospectively we're not going to uphold contracts that seek to waive basic rights for the delivery of necessities, particularly in an unequal bargaining position.
But tell me why this position that I talked about in my circumstance would be an unequal bargaining position. Why can I not choose another physician if I don't like the contract?
Because the other physician will have the same contract.
But assumedly, you're assuming that everyone would.
Yes, I am. And if that assumption seems like quite a leap on my behalf, Senator Menas, imagine what the insurance companies will tell the physicians.
Does the PLF put any requirements on attorneys with respect to their practice issues, how they practice?
If I'm understanding...
Well, I guess I'm trying to figure out, you're all insured by the same insurance company. Is there any parallel here?
Well, Mr. Chair...
I mean, you don't give, as an attorney, one of your clients, I guess, the ability to go... Well, I guess it could go somewhere else. You're just all insured by the same monopoly.
I mean, clients can go anywhere. They're never asked...
Well, I guess I'm trying to get into the insurance monopoly issue. You're saying that insurance companies would demand that all physicians would have to have this particular clause. You're saying that's exculpatory because it doesn't, it's not an equal bargaining power.
The patient's not really in a position to go, and I think they would almost have to be uniform. I mean, the companies would immediately say, I mean, this is going to limit our losses. I mean, they're here testifying in support of it. I mean, what are they going to do? Say, you don't need to do it?
I'm trying to understand the issue, and again, forgive me because I'm not an attorney. But if I came to you for a contract for services, do your contracts have any kind of arbitration clauses or any of that nature? Nothing at all.
No.
All right.
No, none at all.
PLF doesn't require anything of that sort.
The PLF offers arbitration to attorneys. You can check it or not check it for claims with regard to the PLF if we have a beef with the PLF, but. That's voluntary as well.
Okay, so if one of your clients has a beef with the PLF, then they would have a choice to either. I'm sorry.
No,
the attorney has.
Right. In other words, on coverage or something like that. But as far as the client is not at all limited, and it's only the idea of a monopoly. You heard a little bit about investment income, and again, some of the talk about the insurance cycle that was given last week is probably instructive, but investment income is significant not only in terms of that there are investment losses, and I know that Northwest has a lot in bonds, but there is an insurance cycle that is well documented, and there's people much more knowledgeable than I who can tell you about it, but part of the insurance cycle involves the fact that insurers make money, as they should, from investments. And when investment returns are potentially high, a lot of insurance companies come into the market. And Oregon's a great example. I mean, I think 3 or 4 years ago, there was, I don't know how many insurers, a dozen or more. I mean, I have a list of about 40, but I think some of them are very small players. And they come in to get the premiums and to make the investment returns. And when they do that, they drive down premiums because the companies are very competitive to get the investment dollar. Then the investment returns aren't going so well, and these companies that aren't as faithful maybe as Northwest is to the market, they all leave, and they leave a couple of insurers to try to make up for problems. But during this period, premiums have been driven down to artificially low levels. So the loss of investment income isn't just I don't have as much income in my portfolio, but it causes a pricing problem that's very difficult during times when insurers come into the market. And I have talked about the PLF to a number of people throughout the country, and one of the things they say, and I've also talked with our director about it too, is that you got to have a monopoly, because if you set up a PLF that doesn't apply to all physicians in these soft insurance cycles when investment return is high, other companies will come into the market and they'll say, hey, you're paying $10,000. I can give you the product for $7,500. What the heck are you doing? And people are going to switch. There's a company in Washington, and there was an article in the Vancouver Columbian last year, and they're also a physician-owned company, but they kind of kept their rates up, and they convinced their people to stay with the company, and that company is healthy now as opposed to some of the other insurance companies. So we have, and I know monopoly sounds, you know, anti-American or something, but we have an artificial market anyway, marketplace with third-party payers, regulated payment by governmental agencies, and so to combat that, you need to be creative, and that's what the PLF was. And our rates, they didn't go down a whole lot, but they haven't gone up a whole lot either, and I'm paying the same for coverage that I did 15 years ago. Now,
okay, I'm sorry, Senator Brady. And just for everybody else who signed up to testify, we're going to be revisiting these issues in depth, ad nauseum, forever and ever. And really, the chair's objective here is to really try to lay a foundation and some grounding with the members of the committee on these issues, and not necessarily form a specific opinion about a specific bill, and to try to help facilitate discussions between the House and the Senate. We will look at the materials that the House has. We will also conduct additional hearings, probably very similar, duplicate some of that information. But it's my intent to work with Representative Williams, the chair of the House committee, and of course obviously the members of my committee with respect to where we want to go, if anywhere, what's possible, and also clearly what works. So with that, if we're going to continue, we've got about 5 or 6
actually,
minutes.
Actually,
I had a question.
Has a question here.
Getting back to the PLF, one of the issues that always comes up in terms of any kind of malpractice is that, you know, a disproportionate number of claims are from a relatively small number of practitioners, whether you're talking about lawyers or doctors. Isn't it true that with the PLF, because it is a monopoly, if you will, and all the lawyers are in, there is risk sharing. Isn't there kind of a built-in incentive within that system to identify lawyers with problems and deal with them, to provide assistance or discipline or whatever the situation calls for sooner rather than later?
Mr. Chair, Senator Burdick, I think that's true, and I'm not saying that the insurance companies like Northwest don't have some loss prevention themselves, but the PLF is very aggressive in that regard. They're constantly sending out malpractice alerts. They offer repair, which means they will hire lawyers to come help people that are in a problem. And instantly, I realize full well that some of our problems develop slowly and we're able to repair them, and sometimes that's not true in the medical setting. But the PLF is very aggressive. And also lawyers who do have claims do receive special underwriting assessments, which adds to your premium, depending upon the cost of the claim. And actually, Mr. Zyroff, the director, even questioned whether that's really a good deterrent or not, or whether this prevention is better. The Oregon State Bar, also there's the disciplinary arm, and the Board of Medical Examiners is similar, and I think that's really an important part of identifying and weeding out or limiting lawyers or doctors in terms of their practice is through the professional licensing agency. And aggressive work on behalf of those licensing agencies, I think, is very important, and I think the Oregon State Bar does that very well. I can't tell you about the Board of Medical Examiners. I just don't have enough knowledge about that.
Mr. Chairman, if I could follow up, you know, to the criticism about one specialty having to basically subsidize another if they don't get much claims, you mentioned that in the PLF, if they have a negative claims experience, that their premiums do go up. Wouldn't that be kind of a built-in protection to, over time, the people who do get the claims, who perhaps are probably the same people now, the OBGYNs and their neurosurgeons, the anesthesiologists, that they, over time, would end up paying higher premiums just because of the specialty they're in attracts more actions?
Mr. Chair, Senator Burdick, as far as our special underwriting assessment, it would result in assessments and higher premiums for people with high claims. I'm not necessarily advocating that in every instance. I'm saying that's what happens in the PLF. You know, there are instances where good doctors make grievous errors resulting in huge liability awards. Whether there should be retribution in those settings or not, I think, is an issue that's very significant, one that has to be discussed. I think when a lawyer or a doctor or anyone else demonstrates a continuing ability to conform his or her conduct to reasonable standards, then that's an issue not only for insurance but for licensing boards and for the public as a whole. And I think that, again, is where we should have a concerted effort amongst all of the parties involved in that.
All right. I think with that, I'm going to go ahead and get ready to close the committee. But just a couple of things for the committee. I'm going to close the public hearing on this particular bill, 497. We're going to come back to it. A couple of issues. I'm contemplating doing some evening meetings. So if any of the members have heartburns about that or particular days that are bad for them, let me know. I want to try to get some advance notice out so that everybody knows. I'd like to get the attendance here. You guys have done a remarkably good job of being present and asking questions and facilitating us. And third, on Monday, we have one of my bills up, which is a bill creating the crime of terrorism. There has been a lot of criticism. You're probably receiving information in your offices. But what I'm going to do on Monday, there are amendments to the bill that significantly narrow, and it was intended to narrow, but it was drafted, unfortunately, overly broad and clearly unconstitutional. So I'll have the indulgence of the committee, hopefully, to adopt the amendments and then begin the public hearing from that point so we know what we're talking about. That was the chair at least intended. And I apologize that it came out of council the way it did. It's caused a great deal of criticism and hopefully not too much staff work on your part. Thank you very much. My staff's going nuts.
Is that the only bill on for hearing? Because from the volume of emails and phone calls and letters, I think
it is.
Do we have an overflow room prepared?
I don't know, but I think hopefully if we can get the amendments in, it may. Reduce the number of people who might want to take
time. I think you need a new bill.
Well, we might. We might have to change it.
Yes,
Mr. Alexander, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
We do appreciate it. And we're going to be adjourned.